to our DNA structure. So, in that respect, I have a complaint, I guess. I'd like to address Becky's question. She raised a question. She asked a question at the end of Dr. Lover's lecture about whether there is any difference in the DNA structure of an observant Jew or observant Ben Noach throughout generations. I certainly am not qualified to answer that on a biochemical level, but I can only say, you know, from what I have of the Torah scholars, what Torah teaches, it would seem that the answer would be negative. Because we find, for instance, that two of the greatest scholars, Rabbi Akiva was considered like the greatest Torah scholar of centuries, and his father was a convert. And also Rabbi Meir, another one of the greatest Torah scholars. He was so abstract in thought that the rabbis of his generation could not follow his abstract formulas to the full extent of its depth. And these two great Torah scholars, two greatest Torah scholars, really had parents that were non-Jewish, Gentiles, converts, and they emerged to be the greatest scholars. And as you know, Uncleus, the proselyte, he is the only one who is placed right alongside the Chumash, the Bible, and he was a convert. The Talmud says also that many wicked people were offspring of great Torah scholars. So the Torah seems not to attribute that type of, you know, biochemical destiny, so to speak. But rather, the Torah seems to maintain that a person, if a person becomes a great person, a good person, a Torah person or not, is rather dependent on the human being's free will, ability to choose, and it's a matter of the soul more than the biochemical. I mean, that's, I can only bring it from my area. Okay. I'd like to discuss today the prophet Jonah, who really is a very, very interesting prophet. The prophet Jonah, I think, is one which can give us perhaps the most insight into what a prophet is. You know, it's a very short part in the prophets, but it is an amazing story. And when we analyze it, I think we really gain tremendous knowledge of a prophet. And in general, the purpose of the prophets is to teach us one thing, and that is how to relate to God properly. How do we relate to God? Most religious think it's a very simple matter. Torah does not think so. Torah thinks it's something which requires a lot of learning and a lot of knowledge. But your instinct, your instinctual approach is actually necessarily wrong. So the only way we can approach God is through learning and through knowledge. So this, I think, gives us tremendous insight into how a person should relate to God, even though we're not prophets. The interesting story, as you know, is where Jonah receives a prophecy and then he runs away from God, runs away from his prophecy. He rents a ship and he goes out on the sea, and then on the high seas there's a squall, and the ship is about to be scuttled, and the sailors, he tells the sailors, you know, throw me into the sea, and then he's swallowed by a large fish, not a whale, by the way, this is a large fish, and then he continues on his mission, and then eventually God puts him in a situation where he has this kikoyon, this castor oil plant that grows out of the ground, protects him from the heat, and then it dies, and that serves as a parable, and he somehow or other, that's the end of the story. Now, I would break up the story into seven components, okay? The first is where he runs away, okay? The second, where he's thrown overboard. The third, where he's swallowed by the fish. The fourth, where he continues on his mission. And the fifth, where the kikoyon grows. Then the Kikayon dies, six, and then eventually, apparently, this problem, his dilemma is resolved. Okay. Now, in these seven steps that we have, there are two of them to me that seem immediately problematic. First of all, what is this idea of running away from God? And we notice also that if running away from God, if Jonah had been doing something evil, the prophet is always, well, has always knows how to condemn somebody and say this is an evil. That's the purpose of the prophet, to teach us what is good and what is evil. And when something is evil, the prophet points it out and says this is evil. The prophet doesn't spare any words when it comes to giving a determination of evil. And it doesn't spare any people. King David, the Messiah, God's Messiah, when he does something wrong, the prophet points out that this is wrong, this is evil. So over here, we find very interestingly that even though Jonah ran away from God, which you think would be a terrible thing, the prophet doesn't say he did anything wrong. As a matter of fact, things seem to go in his favor. I mean, he's miraculously swallowed by this giant fish, and somehow or other, eventually everything is, he's completely returned to his original state of prophecy, his relationship with God. The second thing in the story, which seems to be difficult in terms of the sequences, he's swallowed by this large fish, okay, and then he continues on his mission. So you would think, well, that should be the end of the story. He's swallowed by the fish, he continues on his mission, and that's it. But we notice when he continues on his mission, although he continues on his mission, he's very unhappy about it. And what happens is that God has to cause this kikoyon, this castor oil plant, to grow. It shades him. And then what happens is eventually God tells him, well, you feel bad about the loss of this kikoyon when it dies. How am I not to feel sorry about this, the entire city of Nineveh? Okay. Now, when the fish swallowed him, he continues, but he still has the same gripe. So if he still has the same gripe, what changed? Why does he continue now? Why didn't he continue before? God spoke to him the first time, and he didn't want to go on this mission. So fine, he decided not to go. Why is it after the fish swallows him and then spews him out on the shore, then he goes, but he still has the same gripe? It would seem he's in the same situation as he was at first. And how does the fact that the fish swallowed him change the situation and cause him to make a different kind of a decision? Now, the idea that a person can run away from God is really a very childish idea. Everyone knows that. Every adult knows. You can't run away from God. Even children are aware of that. And our Masora, the rabbis of the Talmud, teach us that a prophet is by no means a childish, childlike individual. But on the contrary, the Talmud teaches us that prophecy only falls upon a person who is a wise person, great in intelligence and wisdom, and a person who also has tremendous control over his instinctual makeup. And as Maimonides states in the seventh chapter of the Fundamental Principles of Torah, he states that prophet, he says, a prophet never experiences a situation where his instinctual nature really overpowers him. Like he one day just gets lost and he's completely overpowered and he has to get drunk and just, you know, act out his instinctual life. That does not happen. If a person is on that level, he is not on the level of prophecy. Not only that, but the prophet is an individual who is constantly monitoring his activities, monitoring his internal life, and always controlling himself where it need be, but not through the medium of self-control. That everyone has self-control, but he does it through knowledge. Maimonides says he has control over himself through his knowledge. It's a different kind of self-control that a prophet has. A prophet is a different kind of a person. The problem that we have oftentimes is we just think these people are just like us. They are like us, but then again, they're not like us because they've reached a different level. They're not supernatural, but they're people that are functioning in a different way. And the way the prophet functions is that his self-control is not like our self-control. We just, you know, exercise a certain sense of self-control. But the prophet His self-control stems from a knowledge of each situation and a realization and an understanding that if we should follow his instinctual path in this case, this is going to lead to certain ill results. And it is not because, see, we often control ourselves. We think, well, really, we would like to rob and to steal and to acquire more money. But that's wrong. That is a kind of self-control. The prophet understands why that is no good. He has knowledge of the fact he's not drawn into the thing. He doesn't think that thing is a good. He doesn't make a mistake. In self-control, a person makes a mistake. A person thinks that something which is evil is really good. Like people always envy and say, well, why did he get away with that? Well, if that person was evil, he didn't get away with anything because what he did is very harmful to himself. If you really understand it. But if you don't understand it, you think, well, look, this person really, that really is good. I wish I could do that. I wish I could get away with it. That's a lack of knowledge and a lack of understanding. So self-control alone is really based on ignorance. But the prophet has a different kind of self-control where his knowledge, he understands what the good is, and he sees a different world before him, and his self-control is based on understanding and knowledge. So the prophet is a person who functions on a different level and in a different way than most human beings do. And Maimonides continues to say, and says that the prophet has to have a very wide breadth of knowledge. And also, interestingly enough, he says he must be healthy, an individual that is in full health. And he says, and then when he enters into the area of knowledge that deals with God, the metaphysical area, he's drawn into this area, and everything in the world seems to him as being vain and not really worthy of an input of emotion and energy, and he's in a different world, really, in the world of perceiving God. That is the level of the prophet. Now, on that, an individual on such a level, obviously, does not run away from God. That's a person who has a tremendous amount of knowledge. Knowledge of God to the degree that is attainable by a human being. Knowledge of himself. Knowledge of what is really good. And knowledge of what is really evil. This, by the way, is in contradistinction to the false prophet. And I mentioned that I would say something about the false prophet, but then I switched to Jonah, but nevertheless, I would just like to bring in one thing about the false prophet. The false prophet is the opposite of the real prophet, okay? So in studying the real prophet, you know what the false prophet is not, and vice versa. Now, something very interesting about the false prophet in the Torah. Maimonides explains that prophecy is something of which there are two types of prophecy. And Maimonides says as follows. The prophet, it is possible that he will receive prophecy for himself, personally, alone, in order to expand his mind, in order to give him more knowledge, so that he gains knowledge of something that he did not know before. That's one type of prophecy. The second type of prophecy is that a person can receive prophecy in a way that he is sent on a certain mission. In other words, in a prophetic vision, he comes to the realization, God speaks to him in a prophetic vision and sends him on a specific mission. So it's interesting, there are these two types of prophecy. They seem to be completely diverse. In one, it's just an expansion and for the benefit of the prophet himself, just to increase his knowledge. In another one, the prophet is really sent on a mission. That's a different kind of prophecy. Now, the false prophet, in order to become a prophet, first of all, in order to be a prophet, a person must be on the level that is mentioned by Maimonides before. And an individual who is not on that level, of course, would never be taken seriously as any kind of a prophet. But when the prophet appears to the people, he comes in front of the Sanhedrin, and what he does is, he doesn't have to do any miracles, doesn't have to do any miraculous deeds. All he has to do is the Sanhedrin asks him to make certain predictions. And the predictions that he makes, that they demand of him, are very, very detailed. So that there's no chance that a person would be able to make these predictions just through random chance. And this must be done more than once, repeatedly. So that over a long period of time, he has made countless predictions with tremendous amount of detail, and everything must come true, every single detail. If one detail should fail, then he's considered a false prophet. Okay? And a false prophet, as you know in the Torah, is punishable by death. Now, a false prophet in the Torah is not just someone who makes predictions that don't come true. Okay? And it's not even someone that tells you to do something which is against the Torah. You see? The false prophet, even if he tells you to do something which is in the Torah, but nevertheless he should be shown to be false, he's still defined as a false prophet. Even if he tells you to do what God told you to do in the five books of Moses, he's still defined as a false prophet. Okay? So the question, of course, is, what is a false prophet? Why? What is the sin of a false prophet? Is it because he tells you to do something wrong? No, because I can show you a false prophet even in the case where he tells you to do something that's in the Torah. But if the predictions and the elaborate tests which the Sanhedrin places before him, he should fail in these tests, he's considered a false prophet. So therefore, it's not the content of what he tells you to do that makes him a false prophet. Not because he told you something wrong. Okay. So it would seem that the definition of a false prophet is someone who wants to give the appearance of being a prophet when he really is not. Okay. That would seem to be the next definition. If we can't say a false prophet is he who tells us to do something wrong, because even if he tells you to do something right, and he does not pass the elaborate tests, he's not a prophet. So then we must say that a false prophet is a pretender. In other words, an individual who pretends to be a prophet. Okay, let's try that definition. That definition doesn't work either. Because if an individual claims, for instance, that God came to him in a vision and taught him unbelievable ideas, now, even if he should come to in front of a group of the greatest scientists, and he should say, this knowledge came to me from God, and I'm telling you, this has been, you know, give a whole elaborate lecture, and they're going to say, wow, it's unbelievable. And then they say, well, how do we know this is through prophecy? You received this through prophecy. And he proceeds with the tests, in other words, making predictions and with the D-word, with details, and it doesn't come true. He's not considered punishable as a false prophet. So even though he would be pretending to be a prophet, you see that that is not the definition of a false prophet. It's an amazing thing. And this is really derived from the Bible. Because in the chapter where the Bible speaks of the false prophet, the Torah says that God says he taught you that which, he taught you something which he commanded you to do something. In the chapter, it is mentioned, the idea of commanding is mentioned in the chapter. So the amazing thing about the idea of a false prophet is that it has a unique definition. The definition is only in the second type of prophecy. In other words, if the prophet claims that he has this great knowledge that God revealed to him through a vision, he's a prophet, and that turns out to be false, he's not really punishable as a false prophet. He's only punishable if he tells you to do something. But even if he tells you to do something which is correct and is false, then he still is punishable. The reason is because the Torah, and over here you see unbelievable psychological insight, the Torah recognizes the profile of a certain type of individual who wishes to expand his ego in a way that he wishes to exercise a certain control over people. And therefore, you see, the Torah distinguishes between one who comes and says he's on a mission and one who doesn't. These are two different prototypes. One person may say, well, look, you know, I have this vision and I have this great intelligence. Okay, he has an ego problem, okay? But there is a certain type of individual who is fraught with a certain desire to lead others and to get involved and involve others in a mission. That kind of psychological personality is the evil prophet, is the false prophet. And that's why it always has to involve a mission. Because the Torah knows human psychology. That is a certain prototype which the Torah is presenting as a harmful kind of individual that cannot be tolerated in this society. But it's only the prophecy of a mission, which is a totally different kind of prophecy, and the prophecy of simply increased knowledge. So getting back to the original topic of the prophet, we see that there are two kinds of prophecy, and an individual obviously can have both, and it would appear that an individual who is sent on a mission would also have the other kind of prophecy, where his knowledge is expanded. So such an individual, certainly the true prophet, would certainly not be a person that runs away from God. This is silly. How do we understand Jonah? If we take a look at the Hebrew text, it's interesting. To run away from God would mean to run away mipnei Elohim, because of God. But it does not say the word mipnei over here. As a matter of fact, every time in Jonah, when it says he's running away from God, it says mi-lifnei Hashem. Mi-lifnei in Hebrew means from before God, from God's presence. This is found in the Bible in Genesis where Cain went away from before God. What does that mean? There's a difference between running away from God and running away from before God. Running away from God is a childish idea, a person can't do that. Running away from before God means running away from a certain relationship that one has with God. Running away from being in God's presence. Being in God's presence means there's a certain relationship between the Creator and the individual. So therefore, the Tanakh, the prophet, in giving expression to what Jonah did, didn't say he ran away from God. It says very carefully he ran away from before God. Because one cannot run away from God, and no prophet ever thought that such a thing is possible. But running away from before God, now that's something different. That is possible. Running away from before God means running away from his presence and from relating to him. So what exactly does that mean in the case of Jonah? What did Jonah want to do? Why did he want to do it? Okay? The answer, again, is a very basic principle in Torah. And that principle is that Torah places everything on the Tzelem Ha'Elokim, means the human intellect, the mind of man, the part of man that can perceive truth and ideas. The prophet, in the act of prophecy, is not a person who is simply lost, as most people imagine, just prostrates himself before God, I'll do anything you say. That's a simpleton's idea of a prophet, but that's not the idea the Torah teaches. The prophet, as a matter of fact, in Torah, an individual never loses himself, even before God. His mind is always there. If he should lose his mind, he's gone. Moses, in praying to God, gave God an ultimatum. He said, either you forgive the Jewish people or else erase me from your book. Okay? How could a person do that? The answer is Abraham. When Abraham argued with God, if there are 50 people in the city, how can the creator of the universe do such a thing? Because in Torah, a person, if their mind is gone, they're not a human being anymore. God is a teacher. God never wants man to lose his intelligence. Moses argued with God. He didn't want to accept his mission as well. Jonah's not the first one. Moses did not want to accept his mission. He argued with God. The Torah has a different concept of how we are to relate to God. We are not to relate to God in a subservient manner where we just simply prostrate ourselves and we'll do anything. That's a fool's kind of attitude. That's not a prophet. A prophet is an individual who relates to God in an intelligent way. Jonah was on a specific mission. God wanted him to go to this city of Nineveh, which were the Assyrians, who were really very wicked people. And he wanted him to warn these people and give them a chance to repent. Now the prophet, you see, has to understand his mission. It has to make sense to him. If it doesn't make sense, he can't do his mission. Jonah felt this was wrong. He felt these people are really evil. It would be tantamount as an example. I can't say it's exactly the same, but just to give an example, perhaps an exaggerated example, it would be tantamount to God telling an individual to go to try to save Hitler and the Nazis. What would the person's reaction be? The person would say, just a second, this is not a just mission. These people don't deserve to be saved. They've murdered millions of people. They're ruthless. Now, I cannot say, I do not believe the wickedness of I cannot measure the wickedness of Assyria compared to the Nazis. I'm just using it as an illustration. But Jonah was in a similar kind of position. And what Jonah said to God is, no, I can't do this. This does not make sense to me. And therefore, Jonah was caught. He was caught by his mind, by his understanding, and by his knowledge. And a prophet could never abandon his mind. So Jonah was in an unbelievable dilemma. He was in the same kind of dilemma as Moses was when Moses argued with God and did not wish to accept his mission. We don't know what Moses' arguments were. We know some of them, but we don't know all of them because he argued with God for days. And obviously the Torah cannot convey to us what went on really between God and the prophet because we're not on a level to understand what goes on between God and the prophet. Otherwise, we would be prophets. But the Torah tells us what we call Rashi Prophet headings of things. It's important to know headings. Even though you don't know and understand fully something, it's important to know headings. That's why it's important when Dr. Laver teaches us, even though we don't really understand the biochemistry that well, but we see headings, we see ideas. And that's what the prophet does. The prophet teaches us sometimes, many times, just what we call Rashi Prophet in Hebrew, means headings of topics. So, what happens over here is we have an individual such as Jonah, who is truly on a high level, as Maimonides explains, and because he's on a high level, and because he's functioning on a high level, he can't function. He's caught. He can't go on this mission because it does not make sense to him, and the prophet cannot just go by rote and do something if it doesn't make sense. So what does Jonah decide to do? It's interesting. What does Jonah decide to do? He's caught. It's an amazing thing. What the Torah teaches us is it's amazing because you're dealing with people that are in completely different situations than ourselves. But yet the Torah demands and encourages us to study and to see what these people went through. Jonah the prophet decides, and again, the Torah never condemns him. Tanakh never condemns him. What does he do? He runs away from before God. What does it mean before God? Before God means God's divine providence. When we're in God's presence, when it says, God says to the people, he says, you'll make a temple and I will dwell among you, the Shekhinah, which means that God dwells. What do you mean God dwells? Does God live there? King Solomon says, there's no house that can contain God. The heavens can't contain God. So how could a house contain God? But what does it mean? It means to say that when this temple is built, then God relates to the people through his divine providence. So before God, to be in God's presence means to be in a certain wavelength of existence where God's divine presence affects us. And the prophet represents this kind of life to the highest degree. That is divine presence par excellence. So Jonah decides that he is going to remove himself from prophecy. And he knows there are two types of human existence. A person can exist under the Ashgacha, which means the divine will, the divine presence, or a person can just live a life of chance. The animals live a life of chance. Most human beings really are involved in a life of chance. Unless a person has certain knowledge and unless a person is relating to God properly, there's a big world of chance out there. So interestingly enough, what does Jonah decide? Jonah decides he is caught. He can't give up his mind. He can't follow through with the prophecy, with the mission. So what does he do? What he does is he decides to give it up. He's going to leave the world of being in God's presence, the world of divine providence, and he's going to live a life of chance. And it's interesting. The Talmud says that all the prophets were wealthy. And that's one of the requirements of a prophet. Because a prophet cannot be subservient and needy and depend on other people. If he has to depend on other people, he's not going to be able to think properly because he's going to need other people. So the prophet is a person who has financial wealth. And the Talmud points out from the fact that he went on the ship and he paid the entire fare of the ship and he was the only passenger. So obviously he was able to he just went on the boat and he said, okay, fellas, we're taking off and that's it. He ran away, he ran to Tarshish, he wanted to live a life of simply chance. And that was his decision. Amazing, very interesting. So what happens while he's on the boat? So the storm brews, And the captain comes down to him. He is sleeping. That was part of the idea of his going to sleep. He went to sleep and to simply escape from the whole world of being under divine providence. And that's it. He's starting a new life. And then the captain comes to him and asks him to pray. Interestingly enough, he doesn't say that he prayed. Didn't pray. He didn't pray. Why didn't he pray? Because he ran away from the divine providence. And he said he's placing himself in the world of chance. The ones who pray were the sailors, okay? And then after a while, he noticed that it was very unusual, this kind of situation at sea, and he concluded that this is an act of divine providence, but an act of negative providence, and he told the sailors, he said, it is me that God is after. Take me and throw me into the sea, and you will be removed from my fate. So there, at that point, he thought that God, although he is subject to chance, apparently the negative divine providence is really what is taking place, and he is deserving of death, and that was it. What happened to Jonah? What happened to Jonah was that this large fish came and swallowed him. And in the belly of the fish, he says this prayer, praise to God. Now, if you take a look at that prayer, you'll see that in that prayer lies the clue of what went on in his mental apparatus, in his mind, and in his intelligence, and what change took place in Jonah. Where the prayer that Jonah prays, he says as follows. It says, And Jonah prayed to his God from within the belly of the fish. And then it says, he says, I called forth to you from the, he says, I cried and you heard my voice, and I called forth to you from the Mibetin Sha'ol, which means, the Sha'ol always means, you know, the situation of death. You heard me, and then you heard my voice. And then he says, he mentions about the fact that God, he lived through all these experiences, and God heard his voice. And then he says, and I had said before that I was cast out from before your eyes. But now, he says, I see, I will continue to be able to see, to be able to look again towards your holy temple. What is the holy temple? You see, what are you saying over here? This verse really gives you the clue. Where he says, I said I am cast out of thy sight, yet I will look again towards thy holy temple. What happened was, when he said he was cast out from before God, that meant he was living a life of chance. And that was the choice that he made. But then, when he saw that this fish swallowed him, and here's an amazing thing. The Talmud tells us that this fish, it was not a normal fish. It was not a whale, because a human being cannot live inside a whale. But what it was, the Talmud says, it says God appointed this fish. That means it was appointed from the day of creation, which means it was programmed into the creation itself. And it was a unique phenomenon, an aberration. The rabbis of the Talmud amazingly deny and put away the miraculous. They dislike the miraculous. On the contrary, they say that the miracles that we find in the Bible all were programmed into the creation. God loves his universe. God does not like to change his laws. But he programmed into the creation certain events that would unfold at certain times. And the miracle that we see is because the prophet knows from God when this event is going to take place. And therefore, he informs the people, and the people are aware, and they can partake of this event. In other words, Sinai was pre-programmed into the creation. The splitting of the sea was pre-programmed into the creation. But the prophet Moses told the people, and then they knew when it would take place. And that's how the miracle was able to unfold for the benefit of the people. It's an amazing thing. Most religions are really self-perpetuate because they like to tell people that, well, you know, we have miracles for you, we have cures, and this is part of the, you know, part of the propaganda of religion. Amazingly, in our religion took the opposite. type of approach. On the contrary, recognize the laws of nature, that God does not wish to change the universe. And on the contrary, the rabbis did not wish to sell religion. What they were selling was something which was really impalpable. And that's why religion has not been very successful on the whole, because of the fact that the ideas of the religion are not what people are looking for. The Torah does not sell miracles. The Torah tells us just the opposite, that everything belongs to God's infinite wisdom. God does not want to change his universe. He loves his universe. It's his creation. And the miracles that we see are merely things that were pre-programmed into the process of creation. So therefore, when it says that this fish came and swallowed Jonah, the rabbis of the Talmud say, this was not an ordinary fish. This was a fish that was pre-programmed from the creation itself. Jonah the prophet understood this. And then he came to an unbelievable realization. He came to the realization that of God's infinite kindness. We say that God's kindness is from one universe to another, meaning to say it's infinite. We can't understand his kindness. Here, Jonah was able to see, get a taste of what God's kindness is. In other words, he saw that God, at the time of the creation of the universe, knew that there will be a human being that will be caught in a dilemma because he's a prophet. And therefore, God pre-programmed into the creation a certain kind of fish that could give him a certain situation and can teach him an idea, the idea of God's infinite kindness. When Jonah saw that, he was amazed. He was amazed at the scope of God's kindness, different, totally qualitatively differentiated from what a human being could imagine. And then he came to one conclusion. He came to the conclusion that he really did not understand God's divine providence. He thought he did. And originally, based on the fact that he thought he knew and understood God's divine providence, and he thought his mind was telling, he thought he knew that the mission that he was about to do was inconceivable to his mind, and he could not run away from his mind. He had no choice but to leave the world of divine providence. But when he saw this fish that was pre-programmed from the creation, which gave him the insight into the infinite kindness of God, how much God cares for one person that will live hundreds of years after the creation, and he made the situation ready and available for him, then he says, I see I really did not have accurate ideas about God's divine providence. Once he saw that, he said, that's the case, I retract. I must retract my position. And I must go on the mission. But nevertheless, it was only enough to cause him to go on the mission. But he still had the dilemma in his mind, because he still did not understand the mission. He still felt these people should not be saved. They're too wicked. God shouldn't save people like this. They must be destroyed. Don't give them another chance. Another 10 years, they'll be doing the same thing again. And therefore, while he saw he's not equipped to make a decision to run away from divine providence, because he doesn't understand divine providence, and there is no doubt that he got greater insight into divine providence. That's why he says, I thought I was chased away from before you, but I see I will be able to look at your holy temple. What is the holy temple? The temple is a Shekhinah. That's divine providence. That's exactly what he meant. So he gained new insight into what divine providence is and how it works. And he saw he had no right to make that original decision. The original decision was based on a false knowledge of what divine providence is. Once he saw that, he went on his mission, but he still was perturbed because he didn't believe, he did not understand the mission. And there we find the conclusion of the book, where what God did for him was, he caused the kikoyon, the castor oil plant, to grow. It was very hot. And Jonah was in a state of despair. He was felt he was dying, fainting from the heat. And this kikoyon, this plant, grows up. And suddenly he sees he's shaded and he feels better. And then in a short time, this plant dies. Then God says to him as follows. He says, did you notice this kikoyon, this plant? And did you notice how badly you felt when it died? Now, how can I not feel badly about a city which has so many people? What is the concept now? What is the analogy between the two? One seems to think it doesn't make any sense. Of course, he wanted the kikayon for a very simple reason. Because he was in the heat of the day, he needed something to protect him. So of course he's going to feel bad when this castor oil plant dies. What does that have to do with the city of Nineveh and with God? But the answer over here, again, is one which shows us great psychological insight. And that is the prophet teaches us that we are attached to things in a practical way. But whenever you're attached to something in a practical way, there is also a certain emotional attachment. In other words, something that you like, that gives you pleasure and gives you joy, you are attached to that thing in more than just a practical way. You have a love for the thing. If you lose it, you feel sad, certain sadness. It's like a part of you. It's kind of like an extension of yourself. And that was the parable with the kikayon, with the castor oil plant. Because when God created the plant, caused the plant to grow, so it was something which was practical. He enjoyed the shade. It took him out of the heat of the day. But then when it died and he mourned its loss, it was more than just a practical mourning. He was attached to the plant. He had a certain feeling for it. And therefore, God said to him, do you notice how you are attached to that plant? You didn't even plant it. You did no work for it. But it was something that became an extension of yourself, so to speak. Well, I am the creator of the universe. I created man. How can I not be attached in a different way than you can understand to these people? And therefore, in that situation, God taught Jonah the idea of his relationship to man. And he taught him that it was completely different from the way he had imagined. He gave him new insight into the relationship between the Creator and his creature. Once Jonah gained that insight, he was restored as a human being and as a prophet. So we see from Jonah an amazing thing. We see God always demands of us one thing, that we follow our knowledge. And Jonah was caught. But we see that if a person follows his or her knowledge honestly, that God stands by and helps the individual. When we say an apostate or a heretic, we do not mean a person that uses their mind and therefore denies Torah. We maintain that is not true. We maintain a heretic is a person who is not using their mind properly and is distorting the mental apparatus. On the contrary, that if a person would use their mind honestly, they would see the truth of God. And if scientists would study biology properly, they would see the truth of God. If a person doesn't see it, it's because they're distorting the process. And what Jonah teaches us is that we are to use our mind, never deny your mind. We will not be in the situation of a Jonah who really was tested, taxed to the nth degree to use his mind. We had to run away from the divine presence, but he did the right thing. That's what he was supposed to do. But Jonah teaches us that if we use our mind properly, that divine providence will be there because God is a teacher. We say God is the great teacher. Amalame Torah. He's the one that teaches Torah, the ultimate teacher. And Jonah is just a beautiful prophecy where you see God actively teaching man, interacting with him. And man makes steps, and they're correct steps, but they're difficult, very trying steps. God in turn interacts with him, creates situations to teach him and to raise him to a higher level. And this teaches us the concept that God is really for us the ultimate teacher, and that is the ultimate kindness of the Creator. Thank you very much.